In 1960, A Million to One blasted through top 40 radio stations everywhere in America. A Million to One peaked at number 5 on the pop charts, where it stayed for 15 weeks. Joining me tonight is the man behind the huge hit, Jimmy Charles. How you doing tonight, Jimmy?
I'm doing real good, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing just fine.
Good.
So tell me, you were born in Paterson, New Jersey.
I was born in Paterson, New Jersey in 1943.
What was it like growing up in Paterson, New Jersey, say in the late 40s and the 50s?
I guess it was like everywhere else in America. I mean, America was, you know, just getting over the Second World War, and I don't think the Korean War had quite started yet, and you know, things were well. I mean, the country had its problems with the, you know, with the racial issue and stuff, but you know, when you're a kid, you're pretty much oblivious to that kind of thing unless it's right there in your face every day, and that wasn't the case for me. I mean, I had a pretty normal childhood growing up. I grew up in a household with several brothers and sisters. Actually, I had two brothers and a sister and several cousins. Was kind of, you know, a normal family, I guess, for families back then.
What was it that got you interested in singing, and when is some of the first memories you have of actually singing?
Actually, some of the first memories that I have of singing were talent shows that we used to put on in the house, in the living room of our house. And we'd use lamps for spotlights, and I mean, we were kids. My brothers would perform, my sister, even my uncles and cousins would get into the act, and one of my uncles would be like the master of ceremony, and you know, it was just a fun time. So those are some of the earliest memories that I remember.
So then when do you think was the first time that you sang, say, outside the house and maybe a talent contest or something?
Actually, the first time that I think any of us performed or sang, of course, you weren't allowed to call it performing back then, was probably in church. And that would be Second Baptist Church in Paterson, New Jersey. And the pastor was Reverend Doakes. I remember that vividly.
Vivid memories, huh? So were you in the choir?
They didn't actually have a children's choir. Churches weren't set up like that back then. You know, children just kind of went to Sunday school, and they may have had choirs during holidays like Christmas and Easter when they put on programs, but if you sang, it was kind of a special occasion type deal, you know, and that's probably the first time that that I can remember singing outside of the house.
So from there, I know that we'll get to it shortly about singing A Million to One, but from the church then, how did you get into singing then more of the secular songs? Where did that transition take place?
I guess it took place like a lot of the artists and groups back then. It took place on the corners and on the stoops, you know, with friends and guys that that I grew up with. And, you know, we were doo-wopping, you know, under the street lamp. It was a good time.
So those were probably just pickup groups that you had, nothing that was official that you did anything serious with, or?
Oh, no, absolutely. It was just a pickup and kind of a contest within your own circle, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Where different guys would lead different songs and you'd harmonize and, you know, you'd fit in and blend and, you know, that kind of deal.
Who were some of the singers or the groups that had influence on you back then?
Well, I guess most of the groups that were out back then had an influence on all of us. I can't remember specifically any groups. I can tell you that the person that probably had the largest influence on me, and I didn't meet him until I was probably about, I guess about 13 maybe, was Little Jimmy Scott. Do you remember him? He is still putting out CDs today.
Hmm.
And he used to live in Newark, New Jersey. I think he's out in Los Angeles now or somewhere in California. He used to live in Newark, New Jersey, and my uncle used to take me to his house, and he would talk to me, and I would, you know, listen to his music. I mean, he was a huge influence on me as far as my style of music and my phrasing he was a huge influence on me.
Well, let's get to the first record. You recorded A Million to One. There's got to be a big story there. How did that come about?
Actually, A Million to One was written by a guy named Phil Medley, who also wrote Twist and Shout, which was a big hit for the Isley Brothers as well as the Beatles. He also wrote All These Worldly Wonders for Patti Page. And Phil actually saw me at one of the talent shows at the Apollo Theater that I had entered. And he specifically wrote A Million to One for me and contacted my family, and we kind of went from there.
So you were at a talent show at the Apollo. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was the traditional talent show, you know, where you rub the stump when you come out, and Puerto Rico was the guy that would shoot you off the stage if the audience didn't like you. And I actually won that talent show for 4 weeks in a row. And as a result of that, I got a week's engagement at the Apollo during Christmas. I think that was in 1958 or 9. I think it was probably 1958. And so I did a... I did an engagement, my first professional engagement after the talent show at the Apollo Theater.
That was big time, Apollo Theater.
Yeah, that was huge. I mean, that was absolutely huge. You know, if you played the Apollo Theater, actually there were several theaters that kind of made up what was known as the Chitlin' Circuit. I don't know if you've ever...
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You're familiar with that?
Yeah.
That would be the Apollo, the Howard, the Royal, and the Regal Theater.
Mm-hmm.
When you played those, you were big time back then. And so that was, you know, that was a big big step for me.
So you were at the Apollo singing, not only winning four times in a row. It's amazing to win once at the Apollo, much less four times in a row.
That is amazing.
And you had an engagement there. And this was all before you had your top 10 hit.
Before I ever stepped into a recording studio.
How did you get then from that engagement to the recording studio? What process was that?
As I said, Phil Medley. The fellow that wrote A Million to One, saw one of the shows, one of the talent shows, contacted my family, said that he had written a song that he had with me in mind and wanted to go into the recording studio and record it.
What do you remember about that?
I remember that, you know, it was just the talk of the town. I mean, it was huge. You know, I guess it's like, you know, like kids today when they see people like LeBron James or Tiger Woods, you know, and then all the kids want to be Tiger Woods or LeBron James or, you know what I mean? It was kind of that kind of deal, you know. It was huge. I mean, I was excited, nervous. It was great. It was great.
Promo Records. I don't know a lot about Promo Records. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about that label.
Well, that's Promo Records is another story, to tell you the truth. The fact is that we recorded A Million to One in, it was late 58, and it was a year and a half. Phil, as a matter of fact, I had gone off to school in California, in Los Angeles, and Phil Medley was shopping this demo around to various record companies. But, of course, back then, rock and roll was pretty hot. Elvis was hot, and there weren't a lot of record companies that were willing to, you know, to take a shot on a ballad. I don't exactly know how Phil came across Promo Records, but he somehow found Promo Records a year and a half after we had been in the studio, and they were willing to, you know, to take a shot on it. I think that probably because Promo Records was owned by some pretty shady characters from South Jersey, I think their thought process was probably that they could use the record company to, you know, to clean up some money. And I don't think they ever really believed that the tune was going to be a hit. That's my feeling after knowing what I know now in hindsight, as they say. I think that's probably what their thought process was, but of course, as you know, it turned out to be something quite different than what they had expected.
Oh, absolutely. It was a million seller, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely a million seller. Strangely enough, Promo went out of business, and I never received a gold record for it, but I do know that Phil got a gold record from the publishing union.
I see. Uh-huh.
But, yeah, it was a gold record. It as you said, went to number 5 on the Billboard charts and stayed there for a while.
So because of that record and because of the popularity and the fact that it was selling like crazy, did you go out on tour?
Yeah, I went out on tour. As a matter of fact, I was on tour with Brenda Lee, Fabian, Jimmy Clanton, Freddie Cannon. As a matter of fact, Bobby Vinton was the unknown band leader for that tour. Who else was on that tour? Dwayne Eddy, is that his name?
Mm-hmm. Dwayne Eddy, you bet.
Dwayne Eddy, he was on the tour, and Chubby Checker.
Wow.
Chubby and I became really good friends as a result of that tour.
You still talk to him any? Or?
I saw Chubby several years ago. I haven't talked to him lately, but he comes to San Antonio, which is where I'm at now, to the amusement parks here every summer or so.
And so this tour, was it one of those packaged kind of tours, like a Show of Stars?
Yes, okay. Yes, that's right. That's exactly what it was. And, of course, Fabian and Brenda Lee were co-headliners of that show. They were on fire at that time.
Did you ever get to Bandstand?
That's another interesting experience that I had. I believe the record probably still stands. I think I was on Bandstand 3 times in 1 month.
3 times in 1 month.
In 1 month, when A Million to One was at its peak. And I think that's still a record for Dick Clark's Bandstand.
So you've got this huge record, and naturally the thing to do is to follow it up. And you actually had a pretty darn good follow-up that came out, and it would have had to have come out then, almost 2 years after you had originally recorded A Million to One, but The Age for Love was pretty popular in its own right.
Yeah, it was. That's an interesting tune because actually two ladies from Pennsylvania wrote that tune for me. I did a lot of record hops in Pennsylvania as a result of High Lit. He was a really big disc jockey back in the late 50s and 60s. And he is actually the one responsible for breaking A Million to One open nationally for me. He played that record to death. And he actually broke that record. And so these two, they were elderly ladies at the time, too. They saw me either on Bandstand or at one of the record hops that I was doing, and they wrote that song specifically for me and submitted it to the record company, and as a result, we recorded it.
Yeah, that one I recall is peaked out at number 47 and spent about 12 weeks there on the pop charts, which is pretty good. And I've heard some air checks, especially from the Philadelphia area, where they were really on top of that one.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good follow-up. It didn't do quite as well, but it was an excellent, strong song.
Yeah, we thought so. It was good.
So from there, then, you did some Christmas songs, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
How did that come up?
Well, I think direction that, and it was more, Phil Medley was more the catalyst for kind of trying to direct my career and kind of fit me into a segment of the music business. And so we were kind of going for the Joe College kid type section, as you could see with that Christmas jacket with the red shirt and the white sweater and, the clean cut kid. We were going for that image. And the Christmas songs, I guess they just thought that there was a market there for that type of material at that time. And we went into the recording studio and did them.
Well, there was two releases. There was a Santa Won't Be Blue This Christmas with I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus, and then a Christmasville USA backed with a little white mouse called Steve. Did you do those both at the same session?
Yes.
Okay.
All that stuff was done at the same session.
Were they released at the same time?
You know, Brian, I'm not real sure about that, but I tend to think that they were released at about the same time, because at that point in promo records history, they were financially in pretty bad shape.
Hmm.
I mean, it didn't take those people long to kind of suck the life out of that company.
Kind of interesting to have a company in those bad of straits yet still releasing picture sleeves, which is a definite added expense.
Yep.
From the Christmas records, then, I don't know if they made any national charts, but I'm sure they did some regional charts. Your last release that I have for you was called Just Whistle For Me, and I Wonder How It Feels to Fall in Love. What I thought it was the best two-sider that you had. In my opinion.
I tend to agree with you. And those, if I remember correctly, were arranged by Bert Keys.
Yes.
Who was a really hot arranger and producer at that time. And I thought so, too. I thought those were really good sessions.
Unfortunately, they just didn't quite catch on for one reason or the other. Probably due more to promotion from the struggling Promo Records label than anything else.
I think so.
So you had those records, and I guess you called it quits, huh?
Well, the record company was actually almost in the toilet, so to speak. And the president of the record company, whose name was John Woolley, and I don't know all of his relationship with the people that own the record company, but he asked my family and myself if we would stay with him and Promo Records. He was going to try and pull this thing out, right? And at the same time, Phil Medley had gone to RCA, if I remember correctly, and tentatively negotiated a deal for me with RCA. And as fate would have it, we chose to go with John Woolley and Promo, and he was never able to pull it out. And by the time we went back to RCA, they weren't interested anymore. So that was kind of the end of it.
Tough decision.
Yeah, it was just a bad decision.
Backing up just a little bit, do you remember anything about Starflower Music, who seemed to appear on most of your record labels?
Yeah, that was Phil Medley's publishing company.
Okay. And what was the deal with Hopscotch Polka?
Hopscotch Hop, I think, is how they finally released it, I believe.
Right.
If I remember correctly. It was just one of those things. I think it was just a filler. I think it was just a filler. You know, if I remember correctly, when we recorded A Million to One, we were in a little record studio on 8th Avenue and, I want to say 8th Avenue and 53rd Street. It was in the summertime. It was brutally hot. There was no air conditioning in the studio. We must have was either 16 or 17 takes of A Million to One.
Ooh.
And you know which one they finally used?
Let me guess, number one?
The second one. The second one. And so I think that Hopscotch Hop or Hopscotch Polka was just, all right, let's put this on tape and get out of here type of deals, you know?
I thought it was odd that they had originally called it Polka and then changed it to Hop, and I figured they probably didn't want any of the record buyers seeing Polka.
Right.
You know,
that's
just
exactly right.
The Revelettes. Do you remember who the Revelettes were?
Sure. They were three young ladies from Paterson, New Jersey, who I had grown up with, who were friends. They were friends. Dottie Halestock, Jackie, and Evelyn Klein. Those were the Revelettes.
And so were they the Revelettes throughout all of your recordings?
Actually, they were only involved in the A Million to One and the Hopscotch Hop recordings. That was a one-time deal.
So you've been out of the recording business for quite a while. What are you doing now?
For eons. I went into the military in 64. I was drafted, actually, and spent 2 years in the military overseas. Came out, got married, got divorced, got married again, and I've been married to my second wife, my lovely wife, Jody, let me add, for 26 years. And during that time, I taught still photography and videotape production at the New York City Board of Education. Drove a cab. I've done sales work. I've done a number of things. And right now, I have a vending business in San Antonio. And so that's what I've been doing.
Well, is there anything that I may have missed that you want to talk about?
Well, actually, I didn't realize it until a childhood friend of mine had traveled to Cleveland and visited the Hall of Fame. And as he was going through the Hall of Fame, he came upon the one-hit wonder section. And lo and behold, There was his childhood friend Jimmy Charles in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
That had to be pretty exciting to hear.
I was speechless, Brian. I was absolutely speechless. I had no idea. You know, I don't stay in touch with people in the business much, and so I had no idea that I had been so honored with the induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It was unbelievable.
That is that's a huge honor, and rightly so. You should be there with the work that you did.
That's incredible. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
What kind of plans have you got for the future? Any singing possibilities?
I actually was checking with some different promoters to find out if in fact there was any interest in having me perform at some of the oldie shows, and I'm still looking to hear back from some of the people out there to let me know if in fact that is the case.
Jimmy, thank you so much for joining me tonight on my show. I appreciate your time and all your information, and as I think I mentioned to you offline, it's tough to find correct information, and I think we've sure got a lot of it now.
Well, good. I appreciate it, Brian, and I thank you for having me on the show.